to know. She shrugged and offered me her hand. Over the next hour, in between the times when Lana scorched the earth and the hair on my forearms with a few more songs, I learned the following. She loved vodka martinis, of which I ordered her three. Each one was shaken with top-shelf liquor, in whose clear solution floated a pair of plump green olives, the suggestive nipples of pimentos protruding from them. Her employer was an art gallery in Tony Brentwood. She had had boyfriends, plural, and when a woman discussed past boyfriends, she was informing you that she was evaluating you in comparison with defective and effective partners past. Although I was too tactful to ask about politics or religion, I learned that she was socially and economically progressive. She believed in birth control, gun control, and rent control. She believed in the liberation of homosexuals and civil rights for all. She believed in Gandhi, Martin Luther King Jr., and Thich Nhat Hanh. She believed in nonviolence, world peace, and yoga. She believed in the revolutionary potential of disco and the United Nations of nightclubs. She believed in national self-determination for the Third World, as well as liberal democracy and regulated capitalism, which was, she said, to believe that the invisible hand of the market should wear the kid gloves of socialism. Her favorite singers were Billie Holiday, Dusty Springfield, Elvis Huang, and Khan Lee, and she believed Vietnamese people could also sing the blues. Of American cities, she believed New York was where she wanted to live if she could not live in Los Angeles. But of all the things I learned about her, the most important was this. Whereas most Vietnamese women kept their opinions to themselves until they were married, whereon they never kept their opinions to themselves, she was not hesitant to say what she thought. At the end of the hour, I waved Bon over, desperate for another pair of ears to relieve the stress on mine. He, too, was punchy with cognac, its influence making him unusually voluble. Lana was not above socializing with a common man, and for the next hour, they became partners on a walk down memory lane, reminiscing about Saigon and songs while I quietly quaffed my cognac, discreetly admiring Lana's legs. Longer than the Bible and a hell of a lot more fun, they stretched forever, like an Indian yogi or an American highway shimmering through the Great Plains or the southwestern desert. Her legs demanded to be looked at and would not take no, no, nine, niet, or even maybe for an answer. I was being held captive by the sight of them when I heard Lana say, "And your wife and child." The tears trickling down Bond's cheeks broke the spell she had cast on me, the sight rousing me from deafness. Somehow the conversation had taken a turn from Saigon and songs to the fall of Saigon, which was not surprising. Most of the songs of the exiles listened to were soaked in melancholic romantic loss, which could not help but remind them of the loss of their city. Every conversation among the exiles about Saigon eventually became a conversation about the fall of Saigon and the fate of those left behind. "They're dead," Bon said now. I was astonished, for Bon never talked about Lin and Duke with anyone but me, a function of the fact that Bon hardly talked to anyone. This was the problem with a walk down memory lane. It was almost always foggy, and one was likely to trip and fall. But perhaps this embarrassing collapse was worth it, for Lana, to my even greater astonishment, embraced him and pressed his stubborn, ugly head against her cheek. "You poor man," Lana said. "You poor, poor man." I was overwhelmed by a great, aching love for my best friend and this woman whose divine figure was the symbol of infinity turned upright onto its rounded bottom. I yearned to prove the hypothesis of my desire for her by empirically examining her naked curves with my eyes, her breasts with my hands, her skin with my tongue. I knew then, as she focused all her attention on the weeping Bon, who was so insensate with grief he seemed unaware of the enchanted valley exposed to his view, that I would possess her, and that she would have me. Chapter 15. A great deal of what I have confessed so far may seem foreign to you, dear Commandant, and to this mysterious, faceless commissar of yours whom I have heard so much about. The American dream, the culture of Hollywood, the practices of American democracy, and so on, can altogether make America a disorienting place for those like us who hail from the Orient. Presumably, my half-Occidental status has helped me, perhaps innately, in understanding the American character, culture, and customs, including those concerning romance. The most important thing to understand is that while we courted, Americans dated, a pragmatic custom whereby a male and a female set a mutually agreeable time to meet, as if to negotiate a potentially profitable business venture. Americans understood dating to be about investments and gains, short or long term, but we saw romance and courtship as being about losses. After all, the only worthwhile courtship involved persuading a woman who could not be persuaded, not a woman already predisposed to examine her calendar for her availability. Lana was clearly a woman in need of courting. I wrote her letters in which I pleaded my case. Using the perfect cursive taught to me by pterodactyl nuns, I composed villanelles, sonnets, and couplets of doubtful prosody but resolute sincerity. I seized her guitar when she let me sit in on a Moroccan cushion in her living room and sang her songs by Pham Duy, Trinh Quang Son, and the newest lyrical darling of our diaspora, Duc Huy. She rewarded me with the enigmatic smiles of an alluring apsara, a reserved seat at the front row of her performances, and the favor of continuing audiences, of which I was given no more than one a week. I was both grateful and tormented, as I recounted to Bond on listless afternoons at the liquor store. His response was as unenthusiastic as you might anticipate. "Tell me this, lover boy," he said one day, back to his terse self. His attention was divided between me and a pair of teenage patrons creeping, possum-like, toward an aisle, a duo whose years and IQ were measurable in the low double digits. "What happens when the general finds out?" I was sitting with him behind the counter, awaiting the general's afternoon arrival. "Why would the general ever find out?" I said. "Nobody would tell him. Lana and I aren't sentimental enough to think that one day we'll get married and confess to him." "Then what's all this wooing and daring despair?" he asked, quoting from my narration of our courtship. I said, "Must wooing and daring despair end in marriage? Can't it end in love?" "What does marriage have to do with love?" he snorted. "God made us to be married. Love has everything to do with marriage." I wondered if he was about to dissolve as he had that night at Fantasia, but discussing love, marriage, and death had no visible effect on him this afternoon, perhaps because he was focused on the convex mirror suspended over the rear corner. The mirror's monocular eye revealed the teenagers gazing on the chilled beer with reverence, entranced by the reflection of fluorescent light on amber glass. "Marriage is slavery," I said, "and when God made us human, if God exists, he didn't intend us to be slaves to each other." "You know what makes us human?" In the mirror, the shorter of the duo slipped a bottle into his pocket. With a weary sigh, Bond reached for the baseball bat beneath the cash register. "What makes us human is that we're the only creatures on this planet that can fuck ourselves." Perhaps the point could have been made more delicately, but he was never one to be interested in delicacy. He was more interested in threatening the shoplifters with severe bodily harm until they fell to their knees, surrendered the items hidden in their jackets, and kowtowed for forgiveness. Bond was merely teaching them the way we had been taught. Our teachers were firm believers in the corporal punishment that Americans had given up, which was probably one reason they could no longer win wars. For us, violence began at home and continued in school, parents and teachers beating children and students like Persian rugs to shake the dust of complacency and stupidity out of them, and in that way make them more beautiful. My father was no exception. He was simply more high-minded than most, working the xylophone of his students' knuckles with his ruler until our poor joints were bruised purple, blue, and black. Sometimes we deserved to be whacked, sometimes not, but my father never showed any regret when evidence of our innocence surfaced. Since all were guilty of original sin, even punishment wrongly given was in some way just. My mother was guilty too, but hers was such an unoriginal sin. I was the kind bothered less by sinning than by unoriginality. Even in courting Lana, I suspected any sin I committed with her would never be enough because it would not be original. Yet I believed that sinning with her might be enough, since I would never know unless I tried. Perhaps I would glimpse infinity when I lit her up with the spasmodic spark that came from striking my soul against hers. Perhaps I would finally know eternity without resorting to this. Question. Say the Apostles' Creed. Answer. I believe in God, the Father Almighty, Creator of heaven and earth. Even these two thieves had likely heard of this prayer, Christian ideas being so important to the American people, that they had granted them a place on the most precious document of all, the dollar bill. In God we trust must even now be printed on the money in their wallets. Lon tapped the shoplifters' foreheads gently with a baseball bat as they cried, "Please forgive us." At least these cretins knew fear, one of the two great motives for belief. The question the baseball bat would not resolve was whether they knew the other motive, love, which, for some reason, was much harder to teach. The general arrived at his usual time, and as soon as he did, we left, myself chauffeuring while he sat in the back. He was not verbose as usual, nor did he spend his time poring through papers in his briefcase. Instead, he gazed out the window, which he normally considered a waste of time, and the only command he issued was to turn off the music. In the ensuing silence, I heard the muted cello of foreboding, announcing the theme I was sure preoccupied him, Sonny. The newspaper article Sonny had written on the alleged operations of the fraternity and the movement had circulated with the ease of the common cold through the exiled community, his microbial allegations becoming confirmed facts, and his facts becoming infectious rumors. By the time the rumors reached me, the story was that the general was either broke in his efforts to fund the movement, or wallowing in ill-gotten lucre. This was either the payoff from the U.S. government for keeping mum about its failures to help us at the war's end, or the profits from just not a chain of restaurants, but also drug dealing, prostitution, and extortion of small-time business owners. The movement, some insisted, was simply a racket, and its men in Thailand a rabble of scurvy degenerates dependent on the community's donations. Others said those men were actually a regiment of the finest rangers, bloodthirsty and mad for revenge. According to this ever-proliferating gossip, the general was either going to send these fools to their deaths from his armchair, or he was going to return, like MacArthur, to the Philippines, to lead the heroic invasion himself. If I was hearing this gossip, then Madame certainly was, and therefore the general too, all of us tuned in to the humming, crackling AM channel of hearsay. This included the crapulent major, his fat body spilling over the edges of the bucket seat next to me. I dared not turn my head to look, although from the corner of my eye I saw him facing me, all three of his eyes surely wide open. I had not drilled that hole into his head that had given him his third eye, but I had come up with a plot that led to his fate. Now it was this third eye that allowed him to continue watching me, even though he was dead. A spectator and not just a specter. "I can't wait to see the end of this little story," he said. "But I already know how it's going to end, don't you?"
"Did you say something?" the general said.
"No, sir."
"I heard you say something. I must have been talking to myself."
"Stop talking to yourself."
"Yes, sir."
The only problem with not talking to oneself was that oneself was the most fascinating conversational partner one could imagine. Nobody had more patience in listening to one than oneself, and while nobody knew one better than oneself, nobody misunderstood one more than oneself. But if talking to oneself was the ideal conversation in the cocktail party of one's imagination, the crapulent major was the annoying guest who kept butting in and ignoring the cues to scram. "Plots take on a life of their own, don't they?" he said. "You gave birth to this plot. Now you're the only one who can kill it." So it went on for the rest of the drive to the country club, the crapulent major whispering in my ear, while I held my tongue for so long it hurt, swollen with the words I wanted to say to him. Mostly I wished for him what I had once desired for my father, a disappearance from my life. After I had received his letter to me in the States that conveyed the news of my mother's death, I had written to man that if God really did exist, my mother would be alive and my father would not. How I wish he were dead. In fact, he died not long after I returned, but his death had not brought me the satisfaction I thought it would. "This is a country club?" the general said when we arrived at our destination.
I checked the address. It was the same as on the congressman's invitation. The invitation did mention a country club, and I, too, had pictured that we would drive through winding roads bereft of vehicles and roll up a gravel driveway to a valet waiting in a black vest and bow tie, a pastel prelude to entering a hushed den carpeted with the hides of black bears. On the walls, among the picture windows, would hang the antler-crowned heads of deers, gazing with mortal wisdom through clouds of cigar smoke. Outside sprawled an expansive golfing green that demanded more water than a third-world city, where quartets of virile bankers practiced a sport whose swinging skills required both the brute, warlike force necessary to disembowel unions, as well as the coup-de-grâce finesse of tax-dodging. But instead of such a soothing haven, where one could always count on an undiminished supply of dimpled golf balls and self-congratulatory bon ami, the address we arrived at was a steakhouse in Anaheim, with all the charm of a door-to-door vacuum salesman. It seemed an ignoble setting for a private dinner with none other than Richard Head, who was visiting on a lecture tour. After parking the car myself in a lot populated only by American and Teutonic vehicles of recent vintage, I followed the general into the steakhouse. The maitre d' possessed the mannerisms of an ambassador from a very small country, a careful blend of superciliousness and servitude. Hearing the congressman's name, he softened enough to bow his head slightly and led us through a maze of small dining rooms, where red-blooded Americans in argyle sweater vests and button-down Oxford shirts feasted on inordinate amounts of porterhouse steak and rack of lamb. Our destination was a private room on the second floor, where the congressman was holding court with several others at a round table large enough for a man to lie on. Each of the attendees already had a drink in his hand, and it dawned on me that our lateness was prearranged. As the congressman rose, I calmed the tremor in my gut. I was in close quarters with some representative specimens of the most dangerous creature in the history of the world, the white man in a suit. "Gentlemen, we are delighted you can join us," the congressman said. "Let me introduce you." There were six others, prominent businessmen, elected officials, and lawyers, as well as Dr. Head. While the congressman and Dr. Head were very important persons, the others, including the general, were semi-important persons, as for me, I was a non-important person. Dr. Head was the main attraction of our dinner party, and the general was the secondary attraction. The congressman had arranged the dinner for the general's benefit, an opportunity to expand his network of potential advocates, supporters, and investors, with the big prize being Dr. Head. A good word from Dr. Head, the congressman had told the general, can open doors and pocketbooks for your cause. Not by accident, then, were the seats on either side of Dr. Head reserved for the general and myself. I wasted no time in presenting my copy of his book for an autograph. "I see you've read this rather closely," the doctor said, rifling through pages dog-eared so exhaustively that the book swelled as if waterlogged. "A young man's a student of the American character," said the congressman. "From what the general tells me and from what I've seen, I'm afraid he might know us better than we know ourselves." The men at the table chuckled at such a thought, and I did too. "If you're a student of the American character," said Dr. Head, signing the title page, "why are you reading this book? It's more about the Asian than it is the American." He handed the book back to me, and with the weight of it in my hand, I said, "It seems to me that one way to understand a person's character is to understand what he thinks of others, especially those like oneself." Dr. Head regarded me intently over the tops of his rimless glasses, a species of look that always bothered me, even more so coming from a man who had written this. "The average Viet Cong fighter does not have a dispute with the real America. He has a dispute with the paper tiger created by his overlords, for he's no more than an idealistic young man duped by communism. If he understood the true nature of America, he would realize that America was his friend, not his enemy." Dr. Head was not speaking of me exactly, as I was not the average Viet Cong fighter. And yet he was speaking of me, in the sense that he was dealing in types. Before this meeting, I had reviewed his book one more time, and found two instances where his categories addressed someone such as myself, on the versatile side of me. The Vietnamese radical intellectual is our most dangerous foe. Likely to have read Jefferson and Montaigne, Marx and Tolstoy, he rightly asked why the rights of man, so praised by Western civilization, have not been extended to his people. He is lost to us. Having committed his life to the radical cause, there is no going back for him. In this assessment, Dr. Head was correct. I was the worst kind of cause, the lost cause. But there was this passage written on the recto side of myself. The young Vietnamese who are enamored of America hold the key to South Vietnam's freedom. They have tasted the Coca-Cola, as it were, and discovered it to be sweet. Cognizant of our American imperfections, they are nevertheless hopeful about our sincerity and our goodwill in working out those flaws. It is these young people we must cultivate. They will eventually replace the dictatorial generals who were, after all, trained by the French. These categories existed as pages in a book exist, but most of us were composed of many pages, not just one. Still, I suspected, as Dr. Head scrutinized me, that what he saw was not that I was a book, but that I was a sheet, easily read and easily mastered. I was going to prove him wrong. "I wager you, gentlemen," said Dr. Head, returning his attention to the rest of the table, "that this young man is the only one among you to have read the entirety of my book." The table rippled with unembarrassed laughter, and for some reason I felt that it was I who was the butt of the joke. "The entirety," said the congressman. "Come on, Richard. I'd be amazed if anybody here even read more than the back cover and the blurbs." Another round of laughter, but instead of being insulted, Dr. Head seemed amused. He was the king of this affair, but he wore his paper crown lightly. Doubtless he was used to being feted. Given the popularity of his books, the frequency of his appearances on the Sunday morning talk shows, and the prestige of his position as a resident scholar at a Washington think tank. Air Force generals in particular loved him, employing him as a strategic consultant and regularly dispatching him to brief the president and his advisors on the wonders of bombing. Senators and congressmen love Richard Head, too, including our congressmen and those like him whose districts manufactured the planes used for this bombing. "So far as my book is concerned," he said, "a little less honesty and a little more politeness in terms of saving face would seem to be needed." Only the middle-aged man next to me did not laugh or chuckle. His suit was neutral blue, and an inoffensive striped tie was leashed around his neck. He was a personal injury lawyer, a maestro of a class-action lawsuit. Picking at his Waldorf salad, he said, "It's funny you say saving face, Dr. Head. Things have changed, haven't they? 20 or 30 years ago, no American would have said saving face with a straight face." "There are many things Americans would not have said with a straight face 20 or 30 years ago that we say today," said Dr. Head. "Saving face is a useful expression, and I say this as someone who fought the Japanese in Burma." "They were tough," said the congressman, "or so my father told me." "There's nothing wrong with respecting your enemies. In fact, it's noble to respect them. Look at what they've done with some help from us. You can't drive down the street today without seeing a Japanese car." "The Japanese invested big in my country, too," said the general. "They sold motorbikes and tape recorders. I owned a Sanyo stereo myself." "And this was only a couple of decades after they occupied you," the congressman said. "Did you know that 1 million Vietnamese died of famine during the Japanese years?" The comment was addressed to the other men in suits, who did not laugh or chuckle. "No kidding," said the personal injury lawyer. "No kidding" was about the only thing one could say when a statistic such as this arrived after the salad and before the hanger steak and baked potato. For a moment, everyone squinted at his plate or cocktail, earnest as a patient studying an eye chart. As for me, I was calculating how to repair the damage the congressman had inadvertently inflicted. He had complicated our task of being pleasant dinner companions by mentioning famine, something that Americans had never known. The word could only conjure otherworldly landscapes of the skeletal dead, which was not the spectral image we wanted to present, for what one should never do was to require other people to imagine that they were just like one of us. Spiritual teleportation unsettled most people, who, if they thought of others at all, preferred to think that others were just like them, or could be just like them. That tragedy was a long time ago, I said. To tell you the truth, most of our countrymen here are less focused on the past than they are on becoming Americans.
How are they doing that? Dr. Head asked, as he stared over his lenses. It seemed to me that I was being examined by four eyes, not two.
We believe in life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, I said. The answer I had given to many Americans. This drew approving nods from everyone at the table except Dr. Head, who I had forgotten was an English immigrant. He kept his quadroscopic vision turned on me, those dual eyes and dual lenses unsettling. So, he said, are you happy? It was an intimate question, nearly as personal as asking about my salary, acceptable in our homeland but not here. What was worse, however, was that I could not think of a satisfactory answer. If I was unhappy, it would reflect badly on me, for Americans saw unhappiness as a moral failure and thought crime. If I was happy, it would be in bad taste to say so, or a sign of hubris, as if I was boasting or gloating. The waiters arrived at that moment with the solemnity of Egyptian servants ready to be buried alive with their pharaoh, platters with the main courses propped on their shoulders. If I thought that having slabs of meat before us would spare me Dr. Head's attention, I was wrong. He repeated his question after the waiters had departed, and I said I was not unhappy. The fat balloon of my double negative hung in the air for a moment, ambiguous and vulnerable. Presumably, Dr. Head said, you are not unhappy because you are pursuing happiness and have not yet captured it, as we all supposedly are. Correct, gentlemen? The men murmured an assent through mouthfuls of steak and red wine. Americans, on the average, do not trust intellectuals, but they are cowed by power and stunned by celebrity. Not only did Dr. Head have a measure of both, he also possessed an English accent, which affected Americans the way a dog whistle stimulated canines. I was immune to the accent, not having been colonized by the English, and I was determined to hold my own in this impromptu seminar. "What about you, Dr. Head?" I asked. "Are you happy?" The doctor was unfazed by my question, parsing his peas with his knife before deciding on a sliver of steak. "As you evidently realized," he said, "there is no good answer to that question." "Isn't yes the good answer?" said the assistant district attorney. "No, because happiness, American style, is a zero-sum game, sir." Dr. Head slowly turned his head in an arc as he spoke, making sure that he saw every man in the room. "For someone to be happy, he must measure his happiness against someone else's unhappiness.
A process which most certainly works in reverse.
If I said I was happy, someone else must be unhappy, most likely one of you. But if I said I was unhappy, that might make some of you happier, but it would also make you uneasy, as no one is supposed to be unhappy in America. I believe our clever young man has intuited that while only the pursuit of happiness is promised to all Americans, unhappiness is guaranteed for many." Gloom descended on the table. The unspeakable had been spoken, which people like the general and myself could never have uttered in polite white company without rendering ourselves beyond the pale. Refugees such as ourselves could never dare question the Disneyland ideology followed by most Americans, that theirs was the happiest place on earth. But Dr. Head was beyond reproach, for he was an English immigrant. His very existence as such validated the legitimacy of the former colonies. While his heritage and accent triggered the latent Anglophilia and inferiority complex found in many Americans, Dr. Head was clearly aware of his privilege and was amused at the discomfort he was causing his American hosts. It was in this climate that the general intervened. "I'm sure the good doctor is right," he said. "But if happiness is not guaranteed, freedom is, and that, gentlemen, is more important." "Hear, hear, General," said the congressman, raising his glass. "Isn't that what the immigrant has always understood?" The rest of the guests also raised their glasses, even Dr. Head, smiling enigmatically at the general's redirection of the conversation. Such a move was typical on the general's part. He knew how to read a crowd, a crucial skill for raising money. As I had reported to Mann through my Parisian aunt, he had already achieved a degree of fundraising success, drawing from a handful of organizations to which he had been introduced by Claude, as well as his own contacts among Americans who had visited our country or done tours of duty there. These were well-connected men of pedigree, as were those who served on the boards of trustees for these organizations. The amount of money they gifted to the fraternity was moderate by their standards, hardly anything to draw the attention of auditors or journalists. But once the dollar bill was dispatched abroad to Thailand, some extraordinary hocus-pocus called the exchange rate happened. The dollar bill might buy a ham sandwich in America, but in a Thai refugee camp, the modest green dollar bill transformed into colorful baht, ready to feed a fighting man for days. For a little more baht, our fighting man could be clothed with the latest in olive drab. Thus, in the name of helping refugees, these donations met the basic necessities of food and garb for the secret army, consisting, after all, of refugees. As for guns and ammunition, they were supplied by the Thai security forces, who in turn received their pocket money from Uncle Sam, carried out with complete transparency and full congressional approval. It was up to the congressman, of course, to signal the appropriate moment for us to talk about why we were really there. He did so over the baked Alaska and after several rounds of cocktails. "Gentlemen," the congressman said, "there is a serious reason for our meeting here today and renewing our friendship. The general has come to talk to us about the plight of our old ally, the South Vietnamese soldier, without whom the world would look much worse than it does today. Indochina did fall to communism, but look what we saved. Thailand, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Singapore, Korea, and Japan. These countries are our bulwark against the communist tide." "Let us not forget your Philippines," said Dr. Head, "or Indonesia." "Absolutely. Marcos and Suharto had time to put their communists down because the South Vietnamese soldier was their firewall," said the congressman. "So I think we owe this soldier something besides simple gratitude, which is why I asked you to come here today. Now I turn it over to one of the finest guardians of freedom Indochina has ever known. General?" The general pushed away his empty snifter and leaned forward with his elbows on the table, his hands clasped. "Thank you, Congressman. It is my humble honor to meet you all. Men like you have built the world's greatest weapon, the arsenal of democracy. We could never have fought as long as we had against overwhelming forces without your boys and your guns. You must remember, gentlemen, how arrayed against us were not only our misguided brothers, but the entire communist world. The Russians, the Chinese, the North Koreans, they were all there, just as on our side were the many Asians you had befriended. How could I ever forget the South Koreans, the Filipinos and the Thai who fought with us, as well as the Australians and the New Zealanders? Gentlemen, we did not fight the Vietnam War. We did not fight alone. We only fought the Vietnam battle in the Cold War between liberty and tyranny. No one is disputing that there is still trouble in Southeast Asia," said Dr. Head. "I had ever only seen the president dare to interrupt the general, but if he was offended, which he surely was, he betrayed no sign, merely smiling just a touch to express his pleasure at Dr. Head's contribution. But whatever the trouble passed," Dr. Head went on, "the region is quieter now, Cambodia aside. Meanwhile, there are other immediately urgent issues to worry us. The Palestinians, the Red Brigades, the Soviets. The threats have changed and metastasized. Terrorist commandos have struck in Germany, Italy, and Israel. Afghanistan is the new Vietnam. We should be worried about that, wouldn't you say, General?" The general furrowed his brow just a bit to show his concern and understanding. As a non-white person, the general, like myself, knew he must be patient with white people, who were easily scared by the non-white. Even with liberal white people, one could only go so far, and with average white people, one could barely go anywhere. The general was deeply familiar with the nature, nuances, and internal differences of white people, as was every non-white person who had lived here a good number of years. We ate their food, we watched their movies, we observed their lives and psyche via television and in everyday contact. We learned their language, we absorbed their subtle cues, we laughed at their jokes, even when made at our expense. We humbly accepted their condescension. We eavesdropped on their conversations in supermarkets and the dentist's office. And we protected them by not speaking our own language in their presence, which unnerved them. We were the greatest anthropologists ever of the American people, which the American people never knew, because our field notes were written in our language in letters and postcards dispatched to our countries of origin, where our relatives read our reports with hilarity, confusion, and awe. Although the congressman was joking, we probably did know white people better than they knew themselves, and we certainly knew white people better than they ever knew us. This sometimes led to us doubting ourselves, a state of constant self-guessing, of checking our images in the mirror and wondering if that was really who we were, if that was how white people saw us. But for all we thought we knew about them, there were some things we knew we did not know even after many years of forced and voluntary intimacy, including the art of making cranberry sauce, the proper way of throwing a football, and the secret customs of secret societies like college fraternities, which seemed to recruit only those who would have been eligible for the Hitler Youth. Not least among the unknown to us was a sanctum such as this, or so I had reported to my Parisian aunt, a hidden chamber where very few of our kind had appeared before, if any. As aware of this as I, the general was on mental tiptoes, careful not to offend. "It is funny you bring up the Soviets," the general said. "As you have written, Dr. Head, Stalin and the peoples of the Soviet Union are closer in character to Oriental than Occidental. Your argument that the Cold War is a clash of civilizations, not just a clash of countries or even ideologies, is absolutely correct. The Cold War is really a conflict of Orient and Occident, and the Soviets are really Asiatics who have never learned Western ways, unlike us. Of course, it was actually I, in preparation for this meeting, or audition, who had summarized for the general these claims in Head's book. Now I observed Dr. Head closely for his reaction to my prescription, but his expression did not change. Still, I was confident that the general's comments had affected him. No author was immune from having his own ideas and words quoted back to him favorably. Authors were, at heart, no matter how much they blustered or how suavely they carried themselves, insecure creatures with sensitive egos, as delicate in the constitution as movie stars, only much poorer and less glamorous. One only needed to dig deep enough to find that white, fleshy tuber of their secret self, and the sharpest tools with which to do so were always their own words. I added my own contribution to this effort and said, "It is undisputed that we should confront the Soviets, Dr. Head, but the reason to fight them is related to the reason you advocated for fighting their servants in our country, and why we continue to fight them now." "What reason is that?" said the ever-Socratic Dr. Head. "I'll tell you the reason," said the congressman, "and not in my words, but in the words of John Quincy Adams when he spoke of our great country. Wherever the standard of freedom and independence has been or shall be unfurled, there will her heart, her benedictions, and her prayers be. She, America, is the well-wisher to the freedom and independence of all." Dr. Head smiled again and said, "Very good, sir. Even an Englishman cannot argue with John Quincy Adams." "What I still don't get is how we lost," the assistant district attorney said, beckoning to the head waiter for another cocktail. "In my opinion," said the personal injury lawyer, "and hopefully you gentlemen will understand, we lost because we were too cautious. We feared harming our reputation, but if we had simply accepted that any damage to it wouldn't last, we could have exerted overwhelming force and showed your people which side deserved to win." "Perhaps Stalin and Mao had the right response," the general said. "After a few million have died, what's a few million more? Didn't you write something to that effect, Dr. Head?"
"You have read my book more closely than I expected, General. You are a man who has undoubtedly seen the worst of war, as have I, so you will forgive me if I speak the unpalatable truth about why the Americans lost Vietnam."
Dr. Head pushed his glasses up the bridge of his nose until his eyes finally peered through the lenses.
"Your American generals fought in World War II and knew the value of your Japanese strategies. But they didn't have a free hand to run the war. Instead of waging a war of obliteration, the only kind of war the Oriental understands and respects, Nota bene Tokyo, Hiroshima, Nagasaki. They had to, or chose to, fight a war of attrition. The Oriental interprets that, quite rightly, as weakness. Am I wrong, General? If the Orient has one inexhaustible resource, said the General, it is people. That is right, and I will tell you something else, General. It saddens me to come to this conclusion. But I have seen the evidence for myself, not only in books and archives, but in the battlefields of Burma. It must be said. Life is plentiful, life is cheap in the Orient. And as the philosophy of the Orient expresses it, Dr. Head paused, life is not important. Perhaps it is insensitive to say, but the Oriental does not put the same high price on life as the Westerner. I wrote to my Parisian aunt that a moment of silence fell on the table as we absorbed this idea and as the waiters returned with our cocktails. The congressman stirred his drink and said, "What do you think, General?" The General sipped from his cognac and soda, smiled, and said, "Of course, Dr. Head is right, Congressman. The truth is so often uncomfortable. What do you think, Captain?" All the men turned their attention to me, my brimming martini glass halfway to my lips. I reluctantly eased it down. After three of these libations and two glasses of red wine, I felt full of insight, the air of truth having expanded my mind and needing to be let out. "Well," I said, "I beg to differ from Dr. Head. Life actually is valuable to the Oriental." The General frowned and I paused. No one else's expression changed, but I could feel the static electricity of tension accumulating. "So you're saying that Dr. Head is wrong," said the congressman, as affable as Dr. Mengele must have been in the right company. "Oh, no," I hastened to say. I was sweating, my undershirt damp. "But you see, gentlemen, while life is only valuable to us," I paused again, and my audience inclined toward me by a millimeter or two, "life is invaluable to the Westerner." The attention of the men turned to Dr. Head, who raised his cocktail to me and said, "I could not have phrased it better myself, young man." With that, the conversation finally exhausted itself, leaving us to nuzzle our cocktails with the affection one reserved for puppies. I made eye contact with the General, and he nodded approvingly. Now, our host satisfied with our parley, I could ask a question of my own. "Perhaps this is naive," I said, "but we thought we were coming to a country club." Our host roared with laughter as if I had told a most excellent joke. Even Dr. Head seemed to be in on it, chuckling over his Manhattan. The General and I grinned, waiting for the explanation. The congressman glanced at the head waiter, who nodded, then said, "Gentlemen, now's as good a time as any to introduce you to the country club. Don't forget your cocktails." Led by the head waiter, we filed out of the dining room with cocktails in hand. Down the hallway was another door. Opening it, the head waiter said, "The gentlemen are here." Inside was the room I had been expecting, with wood-paneled walls on which was mounted the head of a buck, its rack of antlers sporting sufficient points for all of us to hang our jackets on. The air was smoky and the lighting was dim, the better to flatter the comely young women in slinky dresses arranged on the leather sofas. "Gentlemen," said the congressman, "welcome to the country club." "I don't get it," the General whispered. "I'll tell you later, sir," I muttered. I finished my cocktail and handed the glass to the head waiter as the congressman beckoned to a pair of young ladies. "General, Captain, let me introduce you." Our companions stood up. Elevated by high heels, they were taller than the General and myself by 2 or 3 inches. Mine was an enormous inflated blonde whose enameled white teeth were not quite as hard and shiny as her Nordic blue eyes. In one hand was a coup of fizzy champagne, and in the other a long-stemmed cigarette holder with a half-smoked cigarette. She was a professional who had seen the likes of me 1,000 times, which I could hardly complain about, given that I had seen the likes of her a fair number of times myself. Although I cranked my cheeks and lips into the facsimile of a smile, I could not muster inside myself the usual enthusiasm as the congressman introduced us. Perhaps it was the way she casually flicked the head of ash from her cigarette onto the carpet, but instead of being magnetized by her iron beauty, I was distracted by a striation below her jaw, the hemline between the unadorned skin of her neck and the white foundation coating of her face. "What's your name again?" she said, laughing for no good reason. I leaned forward to tell her and nearly fell into the well of her cleavage, my sudden vertigo induced by the chloroform of her thick perfume. "I like your accent," I said, pulling back. "You must be from somewhere in the South." "Georgia, honey," she said, laughing again. "You speak real good English for an Oriental." I laughed. She laughed. And when I looked to the general and his red-headed companion, they too were laughing. Everyone in the room was laughing. And when the waiters arrived with more champagne, it was all clear we were all going to have a most excellent time, including Dr. Head. After handing a glass to his buxom companion, and another to me, he said, "I hope you do not mind, young man, if I use your memorable turn of phrase for my next book." Our female companions looked at me without interest, waiting for my reply. "Nothing would make me happier," I said, even though I was, for reasons unspeakable in this company, quite unhappy. Chapter 16. The general delivered a surprise to me as we parked outside his unlit residence later that evening, a little past midnight. "I've been thinking about your request to return to our homeland," he said from the back seat, eyes visible in my rearview mirror. "I need you here, but I respect your courage. Unlike Bond and the others, however, you've never been battlefield-tested." He described the grizzled captain and the effectless lieutenant as war heroes, men whom he would trust with his life in combat. "But you'll need to prove you can do what they can. You'll need to do what must be done. Can you do that?" "Of course, sir." I hesitated, then asked the obvious question. "But what is to be done?" "You know what needs to be done," said the general. I sat with my hand still on the steering wheel at 10 o'clock and 2 o'clock, hoping I was wrong. "I just want to make sure I do the right thing, sir," I said, looking at him in the rearview mirror. "What exactly needs to be done?" The general rustled in the back, rummaging through his pockets. I brought out my lighter. "Thanks, Captain." For a brief moment, the flame lit the palimpsest of his face. Then the cheer squirrel died, and his face was no longer legible. "I never told you the story of how I came to spend 2 years in a communist prison camp, did I?" "Well, no need for graphic details. Suffice it to say, the enemy had surrounded our men at Dien Bien Phu. Not just Frenchmen and Moroccans and Algerians and Germans, but ours too, thousands of them. I volunteered to jump into Dien Bien Phu, though I knew I would also be doomed. But I could not let my fellow soldiers die while I did nothing. When Dien Bien Phu fell, I was captured along with everybody else. Even though I lost 2 years of my life in prison, I never regretted jumping. I became the man I am today by jumping and surviving that camp. But no one asked me to volunteer, no one told me what needed to be done. No one discussed the consequences. All these things were understood. Do you understand, Captain?" "Yes, sir," I said. "Very good, then. If what needs to be done is done, then you can return to our homeland. You are a very intelligent young man, Captain. I trust you with all the details. No need to consult me. I'll arrange your ticket. You will get it when I receive news of what has been done." The general paused, door halfway open. "Country club, huh?" He chuckled. "I'll have to remember that." I watched him walk up the pathway to his darkened house, where Madame was likely reading in bed, staying awake for his return, as she had waited so often in the villa. She knew a general's duties extended past midnight, but was she aware what some of these duties included? That we, too, had country clubs. Sometimes, after delivering him to the villa, I stood in my socked feet in the hallway and listened for any signs of distress from their room. I never heard any, but she was too smart not to know. As for what I knew, it was this. My Parisian aunt had replied, and the invisible words that gradually became visible were succinct. "Don't come back," Man had written. "We need you in America, not here. These are your orders." I burned the letter in a wastebasket, as I had burned all the letters, which was until that moment only a way of getting rid of evidence. But in that moment, I confess that burning the letter was also sending it to hell, or perhaps making an offering to a deity, not God, who could keep Bon and me safe. I did not tell Bon about the letter, of course, but I did tell him of the general's offer and sought his counsel. He was characteristically blunt. "You're an idiot," he said, "but I can't stop you from going. As for Sonny, nothing to feel bad about. The man's got a big mouth." This consolation was offered the only way he knew how, at a billiards hall, where he bought me several drinks and several rounds of pool. Something about the fraternal atmosphere of a billiards hall reassured the soul. The isolated pool of light over a table of green felt was an indoor hydroponic zone where what grew was the prickly plant of masculine emotion, too sensitive for sunlight and fresh air. After a café, but before a nightclub or home, a billiards hall was where one was most likely to encounter the southern Vietnamese man. Here he discovered that in billiards, as in lovemaking, accurate and true aim was increasingly difficult in proportion to the amount of alcohol consumed. Thus, as the night progressed, our games gradually grew longer and longer. To Bond's credit, however, the offer he made me was given in our first game, well before the nub of the night wore away to nothing, and we numbly left the pool hall in the first minutes of dawn, exiting onto a lonely street whose only sign of life was a flour-dusted baker toiling in a donut shop's window. "I'll do it," Bond said, watching me rack the balls. "Tell the general you did it, but I'll get him for you." His offer did not surprise me at all. Even as I thanked him, I knew I could not accept it. I was venturing into a wilderness many had explored before me, crossing the threshold separating those who had killed from those who had not. The general was correct that only a man who had received this rite could be allowed to return home. What I needed was a sacrament, but none existed for this matter. Why not? Who were we fooling with the belief that God, if he existed, would not want us to acknowledge the sacredness of killing? Let us return to another important question of my father's catechism. Question: what is man? Answer: man is a creature composed of a body and soul, and made to the image and likeness of God. Question: is this likeness in the body or in the soul? Answer: this likeness is chiefly in the soul. I need not look in the mirror or at the faces of my fellow men to find a likeness to God. I need only look at their selves and inside my own to realize we would not be killers if God himself was not one too.
But of course I'm talking about not only killing, but its subset, murder.
Bond shrugged at my hesitation and leaned over the table, cue stick resting on his played hand. "You're always wanting to learn things," he said. "Well, there's no greater knowledge than in killing a man." He put some English on the cue ball, and when it struck its target, it rolled backward gently, aligning itself for the next shot. "What about love and creation?" I said. "Getting married, having children? You, of all people, should believe in that kind of knowledge." He rested his hip on the table's edge, both hands clutching the pool cue propped on his shoulder. "You're testing me, right?" "Okay. We have all kinds of ways to talk about life and creation. But when guys like me go and kill, everyone's happy we do it, and no one wants to talk about it. It would be better if every Sunday before the priest talks, a warrior gets up and tells people who he's killed on their behalf. Listening is the least they could do," he shrugged. "That's not ever happening. So here's some practical advice. People like to play dead. You know how to tell if someone's really dead? Press your finger on his eyeball. If he's alive, he'll move. If he's dead, he won't." I could see myself shooting Sonny, having seen such an act so many times in the movies, but I could not see my finger wiggling the slippery fishball of his eye. "Why not just shoot him twice?" I said. "Because, smart guy, it makes noise, it goes bang. And who said anything about shooting him even once? Sometimes we killed VC with things other than guns. If it makes you feel any better, this isn't murder. It's not even killing, it's assassination. Ask your man Claude if you haven't already. He'd show up and say, 'Here's the shopping list, go and bag some.' So we'd go into the villages at night with a shopping list. VC terrorist, VC sympathizer, VC collaborator, maybe VC, probable VC. This one's got a VC in her belly. This one's thinking of being a VC. This one everybody thinks is a VC. This one's father or mother is VC, therefore is VC in training." We ran out of time before we got them all. We should have wiped them out when we had the chance. Don't make the same mistake. Take out this VC before he gets too big, before he turns others into VC. That's all it is. Nothing to feel sorry about, nothing to cry about. If it were all so simple. The problem with killing all the Viet Cong was that there would always be more, teeming in the walls of our minds, breathing heavily under the floorboards of our souls, orgiastically reproducing out of our sight. The other problem was that Sonny was not VC, for a subversive would not, by definition, have a big mouth. But maybe I was wrong. An agent provocateur was a subversive, and his task was to shoot his mouth off, agitating others in the spin cycle of radicalization. In that case, however, the agent provocateur here would not be a communist, spurring the anti-communist to organize against him. He would be an anti-communist, encouraging like-minded people to go too far, dizzy with ideological fervor, rancid with resentment. By that definition, the most likely agent provocateur was the general, or the madame. Why not? Man assured me we have people in the highest ranks. You'll be surprised who gets the medals after the liberation, he said. Would I now? The joke would be on me if the general and madame were sympathizers, too. A joke we could all laugh at when we were commemorated as heroes of the people. With Bond's counsel stashed away, I turned for solace to the only other person whom I could speak to, Lana. I came to her apartment the next week with a bottle of wine. At home, she looked like a college student in her UC Berkeley sweatshirt, faded blue jeans, and the lightest of makeup. She cooked like one, too, but no matter. We ate dinner in the living room while watching The Jeffersons, a TV comedy about the unacknowledged black descendants of Thomas Jefferson, America's third president and author of the Declaration of Independence. Afterward, we drank another bottle of wine, which helped to soften the heavy lumps of starch in our tummies. I pointed toward the illuminated architectural masterpieces on a hill in the distance, visible through her window, and told her that one of them belonged to the auteur, whose opus was soon to be released. I had already recounted my misadventures in the Philippines, and my suspicion, however paranoid, that the auteur had tried to kill me. I'll admit, I told her, that I fantasized about killing him once or twice. She shrugged and stubbed out her cigarette. We all fantasize about killing people, she said. Just a passing thought like, oh, what if I ran over that person with a car? Or at least we fantasize what it would be like if someone were dead. My mother, for example. Not really, of course, but just what if, right? Don't leave me feeling like I'm crazy here. I had her guitar on my lap and I strummed a dramatic Spanish chord. Since we're confessing, I said, I've thought about killing my father. Not really, of course, but just what if? Did I ever tell you he was a priest? Her eyes opened wide. A priest? My God! Her sincere shock endeared her to me. Underneath the nightclub makeup and artificial diva gloss, she was still innocent, so unsullied that all I wanted was to rub the emollient, creamy pulp of my ecstatic self onto her soft white skin. I wanted to replicate the oldest dialectic of all with her, the thesis of Adam and the antithesis of Eve that led to the synthesis of us, the rotten apple of humanity, fallen so far from God's tree. Not that we were even as pure as our first parents. If Adam and Eve had debased God's knowledge, we had in turn debased Adam and Eve, so that what I really wanted was the steamy, hot, jungle dialectic of me Tarzan, you Jane. Were either of these couplings any better than a Vietnamese girl and a French priest? My mother used to tell me nothing was wrong with being the love child of such a pair, I told Lana. After all, Mama said, we are people born from the mating of a dragon and a fairy. What could be stranger than that? But people looked down on me all the same, and I blamed my father. When I was growing up, I fantasized that one day he would stand before the congregation and say, here is my son, that you may know him. Let him come before you, that you should recognize him and love him, as I love him, or some such thing. I'd have been happy if he would just visit and eat with us and call me a son in secret. But he never did. So I fantasized about a lightning bolt, a mad elephant, a fatal disease, an angel descending behind him at the pulpit and blowing a trumpet in his ear
to call him back to his maker. That's not fantasizing about killing him.
Oh, but I did, with a gun. But have you forgiven him?